Now, News Talk Radio CJAD 800 presents the CEO Series, insights from top business leaders. Your host is Carl Moore.
Welcome to the CEO Series. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University. The CEO Series takes you inside our capstone MBA class at McGill. Each week in the fall, we sit down with some of Canada, indeed the world's top leaders, to discuss strategy, leadership, and today's pressing business issues. And some of the world's top leaders have spent time with us. Justin Trudeau, Muhammad Yunus, Nobel Peace Prize winner, and the CEO of Mercedes-Benz globally. This show gives you a thin, well, perhaps not so thin slice of the kind of thoughtful leaders our McGill MBAs are exposed to. Today, I'm delighted to be sitting down with an old friend, Adrian Woolrich, political editor and bag hot columnist for The Economist. Thank you, Adrian, for joining us today.
So, Adrian, you're the political editor of The Economist and the bag hot. Am I saying that correctly?
Badgett. It's a very, very difficult word to pronounce. Very difficult for British people, and impossible for anybody who's not British. But Badgett.
So politics are important from a business viewpoint. You were also in New York and Washington, The Economist correspondent over there. What's your take on President Biden?
I think the extraordinary thing about Biden is that his ordinariness is a great asset at the moment. He's not an extraordinary figure in the way that Kennedy was an extraordinary figure, or in his way, Reagan was an extraordinary figure. He's a very ordinary figure. You know, he has a blue collar background. He's not too bright, but not too dumb. He's sort of middling in ability. He believes in institutions. He believes in, you know, the corny side of American, you know, exceptionalism and all of that sort of stuff. And I think that's exactly what we need after this very, very strange episode that we've had with Trump. So, and I think you need somebody from the center. You know, he's in the center of the Democratic Party. I don't think we need somebody from the left of the Democratic Party, because that would sort of exacerbate the very profound antagonisms that already are in the United States. I think I think the fact that he's 78, the fact that he belongs to the generation that came to fruition before the modern culture wars took off is a huge advantage. You know, he's not going to get absorbed into the culture wars in the way that people of the baby boom generation almost automatically do.
You're listening to the CEO Series. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and today I'm speaking with Adrian Woolrich, political editor of The Economist.
Had you ever met him in your years in the States?
Yes. I met him at a seminar at the Brookings Institution, and it was not, you know, I didn't sit down with him and have a long chat. We just sort of shook hands and mumbled pleasantries to each other. But I saw him giving a speech, a talk. And one thing I've rather condescendingly said he's not too bright and he's not too dumb. He's sort of middling. But he is somebody who knows an enormous amount about the world. You know, he's been on the Foreign Affairs Select Committee for, I think, about 30 years, been chairman of it for 4 years. He's traveled constantly around the world. And I think if you're on the Senate Foreign Affairs Committee, you're not quite treated like a president, but you're treated with considerable awe around the world. So he's traveled around the world, had access to everybody who matters around the world. And America's, you know, global position, global reputation has been extraordinarily damaged under the Trump presidency. And I think that he is very, very well positioned to repair that. He knows what to say, what to do. And also, it's not just him. A president is the head of a team. And because he's got such deep experience with foreign affairs and with politics in general, he has a very good team there, very experienced, very hard-headed, and, you know, extremely knowledgeable about the world. And as again, centrist, which is, I think, extremely valuable. We remember, you know, America, particularly after the pandemic and after the Trump years, does need to reassert global leadership, and it does need to give a sense of what it stands for and why what it stands for is different and better than what its opponents stand for.
We're speaking with Adrian Woolrich, political editor for The Economist. Adrian, Trump is gone, but he still has a lot of followers. How do you expect that to play out over the next few years?
We've had this sort of notion that Biden is that new broom, that he can change everything, that he's a sort of miracle worker. And that's not the case. The problem wasn't Trump. The problem was Trumpism. And Trumpism was a response to a set of very profound problems in the United States, which are rooted in the cultural alienation of a significant number of people and in the fact that that America has had stagnant income for the middle classes for a very long period of time. You know, America is predicated on the idea that it has promise that you get better, you get richer, that your children do better than yours. That's what holds the country together. And that's gone now to a very significant degree because of globalization. And that problem needs to be addressed. And if it's not addressed, it needs to be addressed, but it's also something that can't be changed very, very quickly. You know, it's something that's going to take some time. And of course, you know, we have a third of Americans who don't acknowledge the legitimacy of the Biden presidency. We have culture war issues, which are very profound and which matter very deeply to people on both sides. And, you know, that started off with the abortion wars and then the gay wars. But it's, you know, going to be intensified even further by transgender issues and things like that, which both sides feel very, very intensely about. So those things are going to continue to divide America. So I wouldn't be surprised if in 4 years' time we have another cleverer Trump. I don't think we'll get Trump again, but a clever, you know, the great thing about Trump was that he wasn't that good at what he was doing. You know, he was a bit dumb. And so that sort of rescued us. And what we may get is Ted Cruz, much cleverer than Trump. He's not quite as appealing to that demographic as Trump was, but there may be somebody out there waiting who will be a clever Trump. And I think a clever Trump would be a very, very significant problem for the world.
In your book with John, what number book is this for you?
11.
So, and 9 of them have been with John, more or less, if I did my count accurately?
Yes, I think that's right. Yes, we've done a lot.
One with Alan Greenspan.
Yeah.
And then one, I guess, on your column, so by yourself.
Yes, that's right.
How did you choose to write it now? Was it just events were kind of pushing you, both you and John, in that direction?
Well, we wrote this book very, very quickly. And we also, writing books is very quickly is not particularly difficult. You just have to get up early and go to bed late and work very hard. What's difficult is getting a publisher to do it because publishers are enormously slow. But we managed to persuade a publisher in America and in Britain to publish it quickly. So we got it out quickly because we thought that the COVID crisis was a potentially transformative crisis, that we needed to think about it seriously when it was actually happening rather than 2 years after it had happened. And because we thought that the way that we interpret the crisis is as important in many ways, not as important as the crisis, but the way we interpret the crisis is immensely important. So we wanted to be getting out early in presenting our interpretation of the crisis, the way we could think about it. And we wanted to say that what this crisis proves is that government matters. Many, many American Republicans and free marketeers would say the government doesn't matter. It's something we need to be as small as possible. We also say government matters, that the quality of government really matters. And that in this global test that COVID has provided us, the West has not done particularly well, and leading Western powers, particularly the United States, but also Britain, have done particularly badly. And if you compare the performance of China with the performance of the United States, that is a wake-up call, because that indicates that they're much more powerful, they're much more better organized than we thought, and that America is much less well organized. And more chaotic than we'd thought. So we thought that this is pointing the way to a future which is China-centric. And we wanted to sort of get that into the center of the way that we're thinking about this. Because, you know, if you have a crisis like that, is it also a potential turning point? It's a potential reset of the way that you govern your country. And we hope that this will be the case particularly the United States, also Britain.
We're speaking with Adrian Woolrich, political editor for The Economist. Coming up, we'll talk about why Adrian thinks he was so deeply mistaken about the benefits of globalization. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and you're listening to the CEO Series.
You're listening to the CEO Series with Carl Moore on News Talk Radio, CJAD 800.
Hello again, I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and you're listening to the CEO Series.
We're speaking today with Adrian Woolrich, political editor for The Economist. Adrian, you and John Micklethwaite have written about globalization, as have I. It strikes us now that we were naive about globalization maybe 20 years ago. We thought it was an unalloyed good. How did we get it so wrong?
Well, first of all, we didn't get everything wrong. I mean, it is the case that, you know, over the last 25 to 30 years, more people have escaped from grinding, you know, stomach-churning poverty than ever in history, particularly in China, but not only in China. So that is an extraordinary achievement. We must never forget that. But nevertheless, we did make a lot of mistakes. We made a mistake which was that, you know, America could simply move up the value chain, and if Chinese got richer, the Americans wouldn't get poorer. And clearly, a significant number of Americans have had their income stagnating. And we made the mistake of thinking that if we incorporated China and Russia into the global trading system, they would automatically become more liberal, more democratic, more like us. And that hasn't happened. You know, the China is not a more, in fact, China, I think, is becoming more illiberal as time goes on. Russia has become something very barbarous and certainly not liberal. And in some ways, I think we have become more like them than they have become like us. You know, we have become, you know, we had Trump, we had, we have surgent research, you know, populism, authoritarian populism around the Europe. It wouldn't be entirely impossible, this time is entirely impossible, given the level of alienation you see in France, that you might get Macron replaced by Le Pen. By the far right, you know, which is something which, again, because Le Pen is patient, skillful, much cleverer than Trump, again. So I think that would be, you know, obviously France isn't as important as the United States on the global stage, but a party with genuine fascist roots as the National Front has, it's not impossible that they'll take over. Macron is very, very unpopular. Large numbers of French people.
Do you think China might take over from America as the leading power in the next 20 years, 30 years? Is that a real possibility in your mind?
What we argued in the wake-up call was that we are potentially at a turning point in global history. That if you go back to the 16th century, every big step forward in statecraft, in the way that states organize themselves, has happened in the West. You go back to the 16th century, China was the number one power in the world, the number one economy in the world, the number one civilization in the world in many ways. And we pulled ahead. I mean, the West pulled ahead because it took government seriously and it kept innovating with government. And something's happened in the last few decades whereby we have stagnated when it comes to the quality and adaptability of our government. And China has been pulling ahead. It's not just China's obviously been pulling ahead when it comes to its economy, but it's not just the economy. It's also the quality of its government. And I think that we could be a turning point. I mean, I'm sufficiently convinced that this is a potential turning point to say that if the West doesn't do something very serious about the quality of its state, then China will pull ahead, pull further ahead. Now, the arguments against that are significant. We have a more adaptable and flexible regime, and China does have the problem of an aging population. But if you look at the way that Singapore has transformed itself since the 1960s, and if you imagine China as the new Singapore doing that on the scale of a, you know, of China, of a gigantic country like that, then that's a very, very different future that we're looking forward to.
You're listening to the CEO Series. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and today I'm speaking with Adrian Woolrich, political editor of The Economist.
Brexit. What is the state of play with Brexit, and how's London doing?
God, it's the ultimate nightmare being asked about Brexit, because we've had nothing really but Brexit for the last 4 years in Britain. It's, you know, destroyed two prime ministers. It's paralyzed Parliament. It's, you know, dominated all the news. It's now over with, in the sense that we Brexited, we've left, we've got a deal with Europe, a trading deal with Europe. So it's sort of over. And I think there's a very divergent thing that's happening in terms of its long-term impact. That in terms of public perception, I think that Brexit is sort of, everybody's glad it's gone. And there's a sort of sense in which the Brexiteers have won, not just the war, but the long-term argument. Because at the moment, the biggest thing that's going on in Britain is that we're really doing very well with the vaccine. We've vaccinated almost 5 million people. We're doing much better than any other European country. And there's a sort of sense that that's sort of been somehow connected with Brexit in people's minds, that the Europeans, it's not really, although the European Union didn't do particularly well in purchasing vaccines, which we did very well in. We could have purchased them separately, even if we'd been part of the EU, we probably would. But in people's minds, it's regarded as separate. So there's a sort of sense in which doing well with the vaccine, being outside the EU, in all this horrible noise and mess being over, means that thank God for that. You know, it's a good thing. So I think there's a sense in which Britain is reconciling itself to Brexit. But against that, when it comes to actual trade and actual financial flows, the costs are already becoming evident. You've got fish that's rotting. You've got pork that's rotting because these people come to the ports, they have to fill in 6 or 7 forms and they haven't got all the right data. They haven't got the right documents. They haven't filled in these forms. They're suddenly, so they have to dump all this stuff. And you're getting a lot of companies, financial companies, beginning to move out of London elsewhere, particularly to New York, actually. So, you know, they're saying, well, it's just not worth the trouble. And so I think, you know, New York is profiting from this, Paris to a lesser extent, Frankfurt to a lesser extent. So, and if that's just the beginning, economists think that within the next 10 to 15 years, it will put a significant dent in Britain's growth rate. And it does look as if that's likely.
We're speaking with Adrian Woolrich, political editor for The Economist.
So Boris Johnson is a fellow Oxford grad.
Yeah.
You've met Boris many, many times. What do you think of Boris Johnson as a leader? What strikes you as his strengths and occasional weaknesses?
Well, I was at the same Oxford College, Balliol, as Boris. He was about 3 years lower than me. And he was always, you know, a very, very distinctive figure because of the hair and because of the way he conducted himself. Quite a charismatic figure, very, very good speaker. He's been an extremely successful leader of the Conservative Party in the sense that the Conservative Party for the last 30 years has been divided over Europe. And there have been many attempts to sort of heal those divisions. And Theresa May was a classic person who wanted to try and reconcile these two sides, the pro-Europeans and the anti-Europeans. And Boris took the strategic decision that you couldn't continue to be one party divided against itself. So he basically expelled all the pro-Europeans from the party. And that may be the only way forward. You know, it may have been one of those correct strategic decisions. And then he went and had an election saying, get Brexit done, threw out a lot of pro-European people from his party, and won an 80-seat majority and won a large number of working-class voters in the north of England in particular, who never in the past would have voted Conservative. So in many, many ways, he has been a very successful politician. And now he's getting another second win because the rollout of the vaccine is going very well. But this is not a man who knows what the word truth means. I mean, he lies. I mean, all politicians lie, but he lies on an industrial scale. You know, he's lived an extremely strange and dissolute life with endless mistresses, with endless lies. He's been sacked from his first job in the Times for lying. He's a flaky character, you know, and that worries me because I think we need high quality leadership, and high quality leadership involves bright people, intelligent people going into leadership roles, but it also involves, I think, morality.
We're speaking with Adrian Woolrich, political editor for The Economist. Up next, we'll reveal those leaders that do embody moral leadership from Adrian's perspective. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and you're listening to the CO Series.
This is the CEO Series with Carl Moore on News Talk Radio, CJAD 800.
Hello again, I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and you're listening to the CEO Series. We're speaking today with Adrian Woolrich, political editor for The Economist.
Adrian, you've met a lot of leaders,
yeah,
an enormous number over the last 30, 35 years. Name a couple that strike you as moral leaders that you said, that man, that woman, I'm glad they're the prime minister, general, president, or whatever.
That's a very, very good and very difficult question to answer. I would say that Barack Obama, who I've only met briefly, but have obviously studied from afar, and I think that is I think he's a moral man. You know, I think that, you know, he's somebody who's oriented towards his family, towards public service, that he's been he led a relatively good moral administration. He doesn't have any of the obvious failings of Bill Clinton. So I would say that Obama is the closest I could come to that. I think that, you know, Theresa May, strangely enough, is, because one of the interesting things about this is there's no necessary relationship between charisma and morality. I would say that Theresa May was a very dutiful person, a very moral person in the way that she lived her life. She believed in public service. She believed in doing the right thing. She believed in sacrificing herself. She worked incredibly hard in a very uncorrupt way. But to meet her, she was one of the dullest people one could meet in life. I would say that Bill Clinton is a man whose morality is very questionable, from the womanizing front to the hoarding of money front to the general way that he used people. But you meet Bill Clinton, as I've done on several occasions, and that is an amazing person to meet, you know, because the intellectual wattage and the charisma and the way he seems to think that you are the most fascinating person imaginable. He's always got something to say, but he's always drawing you out and bringing you on. I mean, he is an extraordinarily effective politician. Then there are other people who one would like to admire enormously, but it doesn't quite work. And I would think that Colin Powell is an example of that. I think Colin Powell is, you know, in many ways an admirable figure, but he should not have been as cowardly as he was when it came to breaking with George W. Bush. You know, he should have, what he did was to tell everybody in Washington, or get his agents to tell everybody in Washington, that he thought the Iraq war was a disaster, that the weapons of mass destruction were not there, that it was, that all the intelligence was cooked. Everybody in Washington, as I was at that time, knew that that's what Colin Powell thought, because he was getting his people to say that. But yet he went and stood there in front of the United Nations and made the opposite case. So I would say there is a person who, in many ways, one would like to admire, but just in the end was more concerned with keeping his job and keeping in the circle, not being excommunicated from the circle of power than anything else.
You're listening to the CEO Series. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and today I'm speaking with Adrian Woolrich, political editor of The Economist.
So should my undergrads consider a career in government? Is that something you would argue
for? Yes, absolutely.
For? Why?
Absolutely. If you go back to the 1960s, let's say, then the best and the brightest, the most educated and the most ambitious people would go into government as much as they go into private, into the private sector. And in recent years, we've had something very different from that, that people are reluctant to go into the public sector and much, much happier going into the private sector, particularly to finance and Silicon Valley and tech and the rest of it, and not being going to government. And I think that that's a great pity, because government really matters. And the reason why this has happened is partly because rewards are so much bigger in the private sector, partly because the public sector is so loaded down with rules, regulations, and poor management that it can be very frustrating to work there. And partly because of an ideology, which I associate with Reagan and Thatcher. And that ideology is that government doesn't matter, that it's a parasite on the country, that it's drawing away from wealth. It's not drawing away from wealth. It's a vital part of wealth creation. That, obviously, this ideology is not I think of Canada as being part of the good government part of the world. It takes government seriously. It's well governed, but it's not completely free from those things. And I think that also, if you get a decline of the quality of government, it's a self-reinforcing cycle, because good people don't go into government. If you don't have good people in governments, you get all the management dysfunctions that come from trying to manage people in a very heavy-handed way, not allowing them to innovate, not allowing them to manage themselves. So it's self-reinforcing. And you only have to look to the United States to see that is a possible version of Canada's future or Britain's future. And we really don't need to do that. I mean, I just read the new biography of JFK. And one of the most striking things about that is that public service for the Kennedy family, for JFK in particular, was absolutely what you did. You know, it's giving back to your country. And it was also the biggest calling of all, you know, the greatest calling of all. And that's been a long time since that's been the case. And we need to have that sense that government really matters, and that serving your country through government is a noble calling, you know.
We're speaking with Adrian Woolrich, political editor for The Economist. Adrian, The Economist, to my mind, stands out as a voice of reason. So that kind of traditional journalism at its best still exists. But when you look at other media outlets, by and large, we seem so trapped in echo chambers. Are you seeing that in the UK, and how do we get out?
I mean, Britain, we have very partisan press, you know, we have very partisan tabloid press. But on the other hand, to counterbalance that, we have the BBC, which is a global standard of objectivity and excellence. And I used to, as I say, I used to believe a lot of neoliberal things, which I now regret I believed. And one of them I believed was that we should, what's the point of the BBC? Just leave it to the market. You know, where's the market failure here? Why not? Why have it? Now, having seen what's happened with Fox and the rest of it, I really, really, really think we have to have national broadcasters which uphold standards of good journalism and objectivity. And I think it's just incredibly valuable to have that. So I think there's a role for the state to keep that, to have proper national broadcasters with proper news service. But I think that it's going to be, you know, there will be a market for The Economist or the Financial Times, which pride themselves on being middle of the road, ideologically and objective. But I do think that, you know, if I look at the New York Times, for example, I think that they're sacrificing a lot of what made them a great newspaper because they're going for liberal readers who are very, very partisan. And, you know, all their feedback says shout louder. All their feedback says hire op-ed writers who are very ideological. That's the way that, you know, I regard that they're much more ideological paper than they were 4 years ago. And I think that's bad.
You wrote a book called The Witch Doctor some years ago. Is there management thinkers you look to today as people we should pay attention to?
Carl Moore. there are lots of management thinkers who are interesting and good, who one should pay attention to. Absolutely, there are lots. But there aren't as many as there used to be, strangely enough. I think that management in the 1990s, when I wrote that book on the witch doctors, there were a number of gurus who were around, who'd been around for a long time and had a sort of status of sort of seers. And I think obviously Peter Drucker, but also Mike Porter, and a number of older people. There were also at that time big sort of management fads, which were driven by big management gurus, which were driven by management consultancies and driven by Harvard Business School, let's say. You know, they had this sort of nexus. I don't see those sort of things spreading through business in the way that they used to, which is a good thing. I don't think it was good to have these trends. But I don't see the consultancies being as important as they used to be, because the center of gravity of business is so much tech now. It's all about tech. And the tech people are the people who really matter. The tech business models are the dominant business models. It's all about this sector.
We're speaking with Adrian Woolrich, political editor for The Economist. Up next, we'll talk about his work-life integration as a journalist in the age of 24-hour news cycles. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and you're listening to the CO Series.
You're listening to the CEO Series with Carl Moore on News Talk Radio, CJAD 800.
Hello again, I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and you're listening to the CEO Series. We're speaking today with Adrian Woolrich, political editor for The Economist.
At your point in your career, the words must just pour forth.
Well, let's put it like this. Writing is very easy. Good writing is always, always difficult. There's a difference, and as somebody said, there's a difference between typing and writing. And, you know, it's easy to type out lots of words, but it's difficult to make it good. So writing is always difficult. I mean, I do a lot of writing. I've done a lot of writing, but it's never been something that you can just throw down on a piece of paper. You know, you have to keep revising it. You have to think very seriously about it, and you have to be willing to junk it if it's not good enough. So if writing's easy, then you're doing something wrong.
How do you come up with the ideas? Like, do you ever run out of ideas and you have to phone up somebody and say, give me an idea? Or is it just enough ideas float through your mind and through life?
I would say I haven't had a problem with ideas. And I certainly haven't had a problem with having the wrong ideas. And now I've accumulated a history of so many wrong ideas that now I could spend the rest of my life correcting my wrong ideas and still have, you know, and still be going until the day I die. I mean, I think it's not been that difficult doing the sort of journalism that I do to come up with ideas because there's just been so much going on in the world. And, you know, you've seen this as well, you know, I started off in journalism in the 1980s, and ever since then, there's just been an extraordinary range of things, you know, it's things that have happened and an extraordinary set of assumptions that have been, you know, turned upside down almost. So I was a supporter of the Iraq War. I'll spend a lot of my life, apologizing for that. I was a sort of supporter in a rather unqualified way, I would say, with neoliberalism, you know, globalization could only be good, could only make things better. I will spend a lot of the rest of my life apologizing for that or understanding why I was wrong about that. So, you know, there's never a shortage of ideas if one looks at what's going on in the world.
What book are you reading right now, Adrian? Not writing, but reading.
I'm reading this book by Alex Ross called Wagnerism, and it's on the way that, it's not on Wagner, it's about the way that people thought about Wagner, you know, about the cult of Wagner and cultural reactions to Wagner. I think Wagner was, you know, one of the great transcendent cultural figures, but it was also an extremely, extremely polarizing and extraordinary intellectual. He had a lot of strange ideas, and it's about the way that people responded to him, about the cult of Wagner amongst all sorts of people. There's a very significant cult of Wagner in the Jewish population. And in fact, when Hitler took over in the 1930s, the Beirut Festival almost went bankrupt because the number of Jewish people were banned from going to Bayreuth. Mm. And they made up such a large proportion of the audience that it almost went bankrupt and it had to be bailed out by Hitler. And also the first music played in the Tel Aviv town hall was in fact Wagner. Now, of course, Wagner's not played in Israel, but...
You're listening to the CEO Series. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and today I'm speaking with Adrian Woolrich, political editor of The Economist.
You have a doctorate in history from Oxford.
Yes, I do, yes.
So why should we read history? Tell us the thought why.
First of all, I mean, it's extremely intriguing to read it. I mean, a lot of the best books you could possibly read are history books by historians, you know, Macaulay, Gibbon, and the rest of some of the great classics of Thucydides, the rest of it, but Tocqueville. The great classics of intellectual creativity are history books. But also, I mean, if you want to understand them, it's a cliche, but it's true. If you want to understand the present, you need to set it in some sort of bigger context. And part of that context is the past, how we got here. You know, it's to see the present in the context of the great sweep of history, I think is absolutely the best way forward. And if you think of the sort of the great management theorists, I mean, you're all doing business. I mean, you can look at spreadsheets, you can look at numbers, you can look at account books. But if you think of the great management theorists, such as Peter Drucker, what distinguishes them is their sense of history, how the world got to be as it is. And also, you know, I mean, I wouldn't say history repeats itself, but I would say that studying history gives you a large sense of where the world is going. I mean, we have to talk about this because it's on everybody's mind, but the Trump experience, I mean, if you look at the history of egomaniacs getting power, you could almost choreograph a lot of what was going to happen with Trump, I think, by looking at previous tyrants or deluded sort of bloviators like Trump. You know, it's a very common pattern that you see. So I would strongly encourage history. And I also think some of the most interesting history is the history of business, of industry. And I think if you want to understand the basic building blocks of modern capitalist civilization, such as the corporation, you can only really understand them by looking at their history.
We're speaking with Adrian Woolrich, political editor for The Economist.
I was going to ask you your favorite Netflix series, but evidently you read a great deal, so I won't ask you that.
No, I'll answer the question because of the lockdown. Is it a Netflix series? I'm trying to think. Well, what I'm watching at the moment, almost obsessively, is The Wire, which I think is one of the greatest pieces of television ever produced. I happen to have the box set, but let's not fixate on that. And it is an extraordinary story. No, but it's Dickens for our day. You know, it's got this incredible range of characters. It's got this extraordinary plot. But it's also a study of what happens when government doesn't work, when government is dysfunctional. It's the world without, you know, it's the Hobbesian world without a good government. So that's what I've been watching. I'm sorry not to talk about Netflix. You get a commission from Netflix, do you? But.
Have you gone slightly around the corner during the pandemic, being stuck at home? Are you looking after? Are you all right?
At first. At the beginning of the pandemic, I really liked it. I thought it was a net plus to my life because it meant I didn't have to see very many people. It meant I didn't have to go to dinner parties. It meant I didn't have to go to commute. But what I've noticed recently is that I've begun to actually miss, you know, the life, the normal life, the non-lockdown life. And what I've decided that I miss is not just the obvious things, not the good things, you know, like being able to go on holiday and go to good restaurants or you know, mix in society and all that. What I miss is the sort of irritating things. It's the minor irritations of life and the minor triumphs of life that you really miss. Because when you don't have all these things like the bother of commuting, when you don't have these things like people talking too loud on the mobile phone when you're commuting, in the morning, or like people who are really annoying in meetings. When you don't have all these minor irritations, you don't have the grit that makes the oyster of life. And it's serendipity. I must say serendipity. You know, as a journalist, I've always found that the things that I've really learned most have come not from any interview that I've actually arranged, but from accident. I remember once I went to interview a Republican state senator in Michigan. And I spent a lot of time arranging this interview. And I went to see him and he came out with the usual cliches about lower taxes and deregulation. Then as I went back to my hotel, I was walking back to my hotel and I came across a group of militia survivalists who were holding a sort of jumble sale. And they had guns, they were heavily armed, they wore fatigues, and they were buying and selling the stuff that they wanted to buy, prominent amongst which was dental equipment, do-it-yourself dental equipment. That seemed to be a very big part of their world. And I realized that having seen this state senator, I'd learned nothing, but having just walked down the street by mistake, I'd seen the future of the Republican Party there facing me. So serendipity is what one really misses in the lockdown, I think.
This is the CO Series. Adrian, thank you for joining us today. The show is produced by Marie LeBrosse. We would also like to thank our faithful technical producer, Marco Campagna. Thank you for tuning into the CO Series. À la prochaine.
For more info and full interviews, go to cjad.com now.